Hello, and welcome to the Neurism podcast, where we talk to social innovators and disruptors to discover how they would shape a new, more inclusive economic system fit for the modern world. Our guest this week is Philip Jennings. Philip recently retired as the General Secretary of Uni Global Union, which represents 20 million workers from over 150 countries worldwide. Their mission is threefold: to build power for working people in service sectors across the world through the growth of unions and the expansion of collective bargaining, to improve working and living conditions for workers, and to support decent jobs for all alongside sustainable economic growth. This episode was recorded at the Homeless World Cup, so there is quite a lot of cheering and chatting in the background. Additionally, we had some technical problems as we were sitting in the middle of a field, so we've had to re-record some of the questions and add some clarifying notes. We can assure you that the content is up to its usual standard. What Philip has to say is fascinating and so relevant.
Good afternoon. Here we are at the Homeless World Cup, the 7th edition being held here in Butte Park in Cardiff. It's a fantastically sunny day, and I'm delighted to see on the Neurism podcast today, we've got Philip Jennings. I've known Phil for many years, just recently retired as General Secretary of Uni Global, International Trade Union. And I'm very keen to speak to you about the Neurism, what it is that we may be aiming for in the world. As you know, it's quite easy, I think, to talk about some of the systems and some of the things that are wrong in the world, but what is it? What needs to be done to make it better. So what we do in the Neurism, it's really constructive discussion, right? Well, what might work? So, I mean, my view, probably the same as many others, one of the problems, the biggest cause of the problems at the moment in the world is a global economic system. Is that something you agree with, and how do we put it right?
Yeah. Well, I'm delighted to be here. Cardiff is my hometown. I used to run around Butte Park when I was 3 and 4 years old. I was looking at some black and white photographs this morning with my mam, and we've got a mini Stonehenge just around the corner from here, and that brought back a lot of memories. Never did I imagine when I was running around this park that one day I'd end up as the General Secretary of the world's largest global union. And there's one thing that this life has told me: you don't have to accept things as they are. And we have to have the guts to present an alternative. And we have to have the guts to take on those powers that are in place at the moment and really set about changing the rules of the game. You, Mel, and your team at the Homeless World Cup have changed the rules of the game in terms of the way people look at homelessness. You've changed the rules of the people's game, which is football. You've changed the rules. And you've given people who have the most disadvantages in our communities and societies another chance, but you're changing the rules of the game, you're changing the rules of the sport, and therefore, from our perspective, always was you change the rules of the game. And I don't know if you want me to go into all the policy points now, but I can do that. But it's about changing the rules of the game and seeing it through.
Okay, so. I would agree with you. Obviously, we in our tiny way are doing something constructive. But in terms of global economics, changing the rules of the game, to what rules?
Right then. First of all, we have to accept, I know you may not look, Mike, you may not appreciate us looking back in the rearview mirror, capitalism has failed. It has failed in terms of climate, it's failed in terms of its ability to distribute wealth, and it's failed in terms of inequality, it's failed in terms of lifting all the boats. And we have this horrendous situation of inequality in this world and the abuse of power that has brought. So, first of all, we have to dismantle this rampant, ravaging, rapacious form of capitalism that we have in place. And you can do this by changing the rules of the game of business, just to start. You have to change the sense of what is the purpose of business. You know, we have business. I read a quote the other day. He says business is run by economic sociopaths. They don't care about the broader social implications. Why? Because there's no legal obligation to do it. So let's look at the corporate sector. We need new rules of the game. We need to ask the question again: what is the purpose of business, and in whose interests the business is run? We like this idea of due diligence, that every business should be legally obliged to conduct a due diligence of all its operational behaviors and commercial relationships, and to see the consequences on the human rights of the people with whom they have an impact. That could be the consumer, that could be the local population, and that could be the workforce. A legal obligation. This is already law in France. It's on its way in Holland, and it is the German government is now given the German business community 2 years to get its act together. And they said, if not, a law will apply. We have a UN agreement on business and human rights where this due diligence principle is based. I spent my life ensuring that business respected human rights. The measures involved were voluntary. But if you have a legal obligation on a business, many of these businesses are run by, as I mentioned, by sociopathic individuals with a slavish following of the rate of return. If you change the legal obligation, then you change behavior. What we have to do is change behavior. And I think that that is just one idea. I think when it comes to pay, why don't we just say the boss should know more than 40 times?
Yeah.
I mean, at the minute, if you're a boss of a business, sadly, South Africa just lost in the quarterfinal here. And I was thinking at the time I was in South Africa, and I was in a panel, and we discovered that someone working in a shop would have to work 1,000 years to earn the same as the chairman of the company. So let's have a new rule. If it's over 40 to 1, then it shouldn't apply. Also, let's get workers on the board. Workers on the board of every company.
So in terms of these things, how are these enforced? I mean, companies at the moment have to abide by audit. They have to get their books audited.
Yeah.
If they don't get their books audited, they get fined, they can get put out of business. Yeah. So you're saying that the sort of things that you're talking about in terms of due diligence, pay differentials, have to be in that audit, and if they're failing them, they have the same issues as if they were to fail an audit.
It's a kind of it's ensuring that when a business says it will respect the right to organize, they have an obligation to do so. That when they have respect the right of workers to associate into a union, then it needs an obligation to do so. When they say they respect collective bargaining, then they have to do so. When they say there's no child labor, then they have to make sure, they have an obligation to ensure that all of these basic human rights principles, which have been on the statute book for many decades, are respected in practice. They have a duty to undertake due diligence. It's borrowed, you know, sometimes you have to use a language that they understand. There's not one business leader that doesn't understand what due diligence means when it comes to finances. We're trying to stretch that into the environment, stretch that into the field of human rights, and stretch that into the whole way and manners in which the workforce is treated. One day we're going to get a global treaty. One day this is going to happen. It will be the new ism.
Here, Mel asks Phil if it has to be a global treaty because of the way the modern financial system works. Is there an alternative? Do we have to keep nation states and global brands, or can we return to a more local economy?
Look, we have a football tournament. The teams on that territory have got an adversary in front of them. And there is no question that in this world of global supply chains, where you have, the top multinational companies have more economic weight than individual nation states. So we are obliged to develop policies and programs that deal with multinationals. Now, when you talk about the variance of providing economic services, then there's a whole new variety of models that we could pursue. I mean, the labor movement were fanatics about the cooperative. That's how we started. We used to collect things together to make sure that people had a decent burial. And then to have, you know, kind of insurance policies and all the rest of it. This local dimension, and I think it is a pushback against globalization that it starts in the local community. I live in Switzerland, and I tell you, the buzz in Switzerland, what makes that place turn is the local communities. They have real statutory authority.
That's right.
They're responsible for their energy policy. I mean, I live in a village of 800 people, and we've got 50 societies. Yeah. I mean, you know, so it's all thriving and buzzing, and then, you know, the local council are really eager to get some big multinational, and then when they look closer, when they look closer at their economy, there's people, there's new forms of business in the environment, there's new social businesses in terms of workspaces. And so you have this idea that you fall to your knees to get in this inward investment, but the reality is that all around you have these new forms of enterprises being encouraged. So therefore you need the whole ecosystem around it. And so the financial system has to become attuned to the local community. They have to open local bank branches again. You know, an ATM doesn't know what the hell's going on in a local community, but people used to know what the realities were and building trust and so forth. So the alternative in terms of business structures is really important. But at the end of the day, I will not be distracted, or I wasn't distracted, from the nature of the beasts that I was dealing with in this global economy. And they didn't give a damn about the people that work for them and the consequences and the lies that they told us. Look, I'm sorry about this, but the Bangladesh, on April the 24th, 2013, I get a phone call in my office from a garment worker in Bangladesh, in Dhaka, where the Rana Plaza factory collapsed. And in a space of an hour, we discovered that 1,300 people had died and 2,500 people had been injured. And because we had commercial workers, we were in the supply chain. And we discovered that this place had been inspected and audited in a voluntary basis and given a clean bill of health. And the companies kind of held up and said, you know, this place was inspected, we can't understand. The reality was this place was unsafe. The workers went on strike. They were told that if they didn't go back to work, they'd all lose their jobs and their livelihoods. They went back in and lost their lives. And we said immediately, we're going to change the rules of the game. You can forget these voluntary agreements. We're going to make a legally binding agreement on factory inspection and so on and so forth. And that's what we managed to do. And we reckon we've saved 10,000 lives. We've inspected 2,500 factories. And at the end of the day, that touches the local community, because there's 2.5 million Bangladeshis working in these so-called local businesses, which are fed by the big global conglomerate machines. And we've made a difference on the ground. So that's why I'm so, I don't want to lose sight of the nature of the economic power of the beasts in front of us, the political influence they have, how they change the economic weather, the threats that they are able to impose on politicians and business leaders. And I like to think that there's a lot of Davids out there, and that's where the alternative enterprise comes in, the reinvigoration of the cooperative movement. And social enterprises. I mean, my two kids, my daughter's in alternative healthcare, and my son, she's an independent business person, frankly, but she's doing it. It's outside of the system in a sense. My son's a hip hop producer. There's two of them in an office with a whole posse of of performers and artists.
Yeah.
And so it's a totally different life from me. Yeah. But it's valid. It's real. It's small. It's local. And it's good. And therefore, I think the renaissance in communities and action and keeping it local in terms of in all aspects requires a rebirth of this sense of community, like you feel a sense of community here today.
So I can feel your passion on this, Phil. You're very passionate about it. Obviously, work is down. Tell me about where the tax fits in here, because you know a lot of these bigger companies are avoiding tax. Tax has become, it seems, a dirty word. So even if people are not avoiding it, they now accountants are very smart at making sure you don't pay it, because why should we pay it? And yet it's surely obvious you need tax to pay for public services,
of course.
But tax goes to government. A lot of people are, if you like, anti-tax, because they don't trust government to actually spend the money properly.
Yeah.
So there's a lack of confidence in government and leadership.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in just exploring that whole area with you. It's like, okay, let's start with the tax. So how are we going to tax the international corporations properly? And how are we going to get people to feel confident that they're happy to pay tax, because it's, you know, you need the public services.
Well, first of all, let's look at the tax evasion and tax avoidance. There is the equivalent of 10% of the world's GMP currently lodged in tax havens out there. And no one knows, they don't really know where this money is, but that's 10% of the world's GMP. If we could just take 1% of that, we could provide a basic universal social protection for the entire planet. If we could reduce arms expenditure, and that's linked to tax as well, we spent 1.8 trillion of government dosh on the arms industry. Frankly, 1% of that would feed the malnourished people in this world. We have managed on the labor side to introduce into the G20 conversations, into the OECD and elsewhere, a process whereby we tried to end avoidance and evasion. The steps taken are modest. There's questions about the disclosure arrangements, that there's talk about us trying to bring in a financial registry, that every instrument should be registered so we know where we follow the money. And therefore, the abuses, I think it's curious, it's probably the people who are abusing the system are at the same time speaking out of the other side of their mouth saying you can't trust government with taxes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's double talk. One side says, you know, I'm a good citizen, but they're avoiding their taxes. And the other side says you can't trust government. I think we have to, there has to be this reconnection about what this, really what this social wage is all about. And for us to talk about what it means. And I think in the UK now, you've had 10 years of austerity. There's not a council up and down the land that has not been forced. They've been starved of government funding. This Tory bunch have tried to deflect the blame into local communities, and everyone is suffering. And then you look at then you start looking at your own infrastructure. Then you start looking at your health system. Then you start looking at your transport system. Then you start looking at your education system. Then you start looking at the falling roles of teachers. And then you begin to see the shortages that are emerging left, right, and center. And then the realization will be why. The business community is not answering the call. And why? Because the public purse is being starved. The countries which are the happiest in the world regularly are all up in the Nordic area. They have the highest levels of taxation in the world.
Yeah.
And when you talk to the people up there, they're happy to pay for it. Why? Because they have a sense of a social contract.
But
it's the social contract that's missing.
Yeah, so that's very important, because then people are happy to pay the taxes because they understand where the money's coming from and the services they get back.
Yes. We shouldn't be ashamed of what our public services are about. There's been in this wave of change, the social contract for us ended in the mid-70s. And this was all part of, I remember when Ronald Reagan said, you know, the worst thing is, he says, the worst thing is government, and the government rings up and says, how can I help you? So there's been this kind of driven skepticism, cynicism, and critique of the ability of the public or of the public institutions to provide services. But at the end of the day, we rely on them. And, you know, look at when you privatize water, what happens? When you privatize transport, what happens? When you try and privatize the health system, what happens? The social contract gets shattered into 1,000 tiny pieces. And then what? And then the results are that people begin to feel that there's this kind of desperation. They feel angry. They feel that when we do our opinion polls of workers around the world, they say, no one cares about us anymore. Nobody cares. And then there's trust. Then the trust gets broken. Then the anger comes in. And then the haters and the xenophobes and the racists and the haters begin to make hay with this sense of discontent. Making the case again for public services and for healthcare. That's why in the US election taking place now, there is this kind of swing more to the left. And there's I think the healthcare piece of it is right there. Because you have so many Americans who just can't afford decent healthcare. They can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the central things there is about the use of the word trust.
Yeah.
So if we're looking at this new ism going forward, a key part of the values, and the economists from the past, Marx or Adam Smith, doesn't matter, they begin, their philosophies are about the values. So So one of the key values that you're talking about is trust, and trust is broken.
Yeah.
So you're talking about a Scandinavian model, for example, whereby, or Swiss, whereby there's a link between the community and the people who are running government. Yeah. So we need to build that trust up again globally.
Yeah.
So that we trust the fact that people will pay taxes and that tax is going to be spent effectively.
But you build trust by being treated fairly.
Yeah.
If you feel abused, if you know you're getting shortchanged, if you know you can't get proper healthcare, if you know that your kids are being channeled into a school where the facilities aren't there, if you can see the housing stuff being demolished and only open to a select few, then you need a change in the way that people are treated at work. And that's why a new ISM for you is a universal labor guarantee.
Yeah.
And when you look at the world's workforce today, we've got 3.2 billion people in the world's workforce. 1 billion of them is surviving on less than $2 a day. And over two-thirds of that workforce are in what we call vulnerable work, where there's no proper contract. They don't know what they're going to earn. They don't know what their hours are. Now, okay, I know that there's a chunk of this who are informal street traders and so forth, but this degree of informality that we are seeing means that we need a new deal for working people. We need what we call a universal labor guarantee. What does that mean? The right to associate, a right to a living wage, a right to social protection, a right to be free of discrimination, that we end child labor. And then, so you can build trust by treating people fairly. And the situation we have at the minute is that the people at work around the world realize that their wages don't carry the same weight. In this country, you have 14 million people living in poverty. We got 4 million kids, and both parents at work, and they're still living in poverty.
Yeah,
so you build trust by treating people fairly at work, and that's the price that all our economies have paid for the hammering that the trade union movement has taken. The hammering that we have in trying to get people organized, the cutting of collective agreements, and the weakening of labor laws to enable us to do our tasks. And there seems to be there's rethinking taking place out there. Even the IMF has admitted the pendulum has swung too far. And this global commission I was involved in, we came up with this idea that we need a universal labor guarantee for all workers, whether you're a gig worker, an informal worker in Asia, or you're in full-time employment and you can't get a union contract, whatever it is. A universal labor guarantee is a way of building trust.
And are you a believer in what some of the ideas that they're coming out of Holland, where they're kind of giving everyone a basic wage regardless? Is that something you think is part of a solution?
I think I'm too stuck in my ways.
You don't like that?
I'm stuck in my ways in the sense that I've spent my life trying to organize workers, getting a collective agreement, and seeing how that collective agreement in all its aspects improves people's lives, improves their well-being, improves their opportunities. I've seen also in my life how we've tried I benefited from public housing, I benefited from public education, I benefited from National Health Service, and my fear is, I'm very attracted to the idea, don't get me wrong, but I'm worried about getting it into the wrong hands, and that this is seen as a way of avoiding people like the union movement to an extent, collective bargaining to an extent, and an overall commitment to what public service provision is all about. Because my fear is that you give people this basic income, and that's it. Then you're on your own. I don't know what it means for education, for housing, and for healthcare. But I'm attracted to the idea. Why? Because it's a new thought. It's making people think in another way about what it means to have a living wage, to reintroduce to the conversation that you need this basic income to survive. I'm worried about the broader implications about what it means, but I think there's a lot of merit in the idea. So I'm not really being, I'm standing, I'm kind
well,
of
I mean,
on,
I mean,
I'm kind of on the fence, but I'm worried about the implications about what it means.
Here, Mel asks Phil what he thinks about artificial intelligence. It's inevitable now, and they say it's going to take half of our jobs. What would be our purpose then? Would it just be leisure all the time?
My thinking on this has been, when you hear these alarmist analyses taking place I know the Oxford University people did their survey a few years back and said that 47% of all jobs in America will disappear until you looked at the small print. And then there were, then, so that I used as a kind of, as a wake-up call for policymakers in this sense, that we're not prepared for the degree of transformation that has taken place in the world. And therefore, what we've tried to do is to build a sense of what a new social contract looks like in this context. There is no doubt that the transformation in work is real. The OECD latest figures is 14% of all jobs will be replaced, and 32% of all jobs will require some kind of retraining and a re-education or whatever it is. So you're talking about half the workforce. But and therefore, the wealth in the world is not going to diminish. Okay, the economic cake is going to continue to grow, and artificial intelligence will play a role in that. And what we have to do is to ensure that around this transformation of work, that we invest in people's capabilities, we invest in the institutions of work, we invest in sustainable development, and we invest in decent work. When we look at the numbers, we can create hundreds of millions of jobs in the green economy, hundreds of millions of jobs in the care economy. We're not investing in infrastructure. That's another great job creator. So I feel that the worry is that the institutions that we have are leaving us ill-prepared and workers ill-prepared to face these transformations. And then everybody's got a big responsibility to ensure that people have opportunities to redevelop and skill and to work less, for goodness sake. You know, just to work less. I mean, if you can get the job done in 15 hours, I like the TUC, they want a four-day week. Other unions are in the same direction. How can we free up our working time in a sense that we can enjoy events like this, that I can say, I work, I have a universal labor guarantee will give me a basic income, and then I'm going to have 3 or 4 days a week free where I can do something. And then to create that sense of public service in another guise, to give people the freedom of the time, because we will have the time.
I think we're probably just about out of time here. Any other kind of theme that you think in a new ism? So I'm hearing about, you know, trust, cooperative, yeah, cooperative, local, you know, etc. Respect in terms of government, understanding public sector, all of that, the role of the worker. Any other, just finally, part or value that you think in this new ism we can say, right, here's a book, here's a bit of paper with a theory, and you build that, create that theory, and you'll create a better world.
Peace. We don't talk about peace. We don't talk peace, the values of peace, what it means to be at peace, to be at peace with your neighbor, to be at peace with your nation, to be at peace in the community of nations.
Here, Phil says that he was very struck when he met survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear attacks.
They won the Nobel Peace Prize just 2 years ago, and they've now got a UN treaty to basically end nuclear weapons. We shouldn't forget this. There are now 14,000 nuclear weapons in the world. 1,800 are trigger ready. They could go up at any time. So I think that's the big picture of peace. We're spending $1.8 trillion a year at defense. Why can't we reduce that by 10% a year? And then to make war illegal. I mean, there was an agreement after the First World War that war was actually declared illegal. 60 governments came together and said, war is illegal. There will be no more war. So this idea of peace, to have this kind of a sense of a culture of peace, to have a sense of the importance of peace, and peace through human rights, peace through respecting climate, peace through respecting human rights. I think this idea of the work that you're doing, never forget. I appeal to you to also develop your thoughts on peace, what it means, how to achieve it, and I think through that all of the developments become possible. Peace.
Peace is absolutely key.
Peace, brother. Peace, Mel.
Absolutely fascinating to talk to you. And your passion's absolutely clear, and it's very clear what a vision you have of what the world might look like. So thank you very much, sir.
Thanks,
and
we'll
enjoy some football at the Homeless World Cup now.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you. All the best. Thanks, Mel.
Cheers.
Thank you both.
Cheers.
Thank you.